Today's lecture is a political lecture, which is one we haven't had for a while, issuing in the politics of North America from the Glorious Revolution, remember that, right the way through to the end of the French Indian War in 1763. This period, this 73-year period, is one of territorial expansion. The 18th century dawns with British North America still slightly disjointed, not a contiguous whole on the eastern United States, and quite a few new colonies are founded in the 18th century to complete British control of the East Coast. So it's all about this sort of filling in of these gaps. Sometimes those gaps are filled in by war with a neighbouring competing power, for example, Spain or France or the Dutch. More often, though, it's about expanding into areas which haven't hitherto been settled. It's about, or should I say, settled by Europeans. Of course, sometimes these areas are settled by Native Americans. Territorial expansion, therefore, does bring in an imperial dimension into warfare, into North America for the very first time, really. It's about competing empires in North America. And what you'll see through the course of this lecture is a very close and intimate relationship between North American warfare and European, and sometimes extra-European warfare. These conflicts between Britain, Spain, and France are no longer confined to Europe or confined to America. They're actually, in some respects, global conflicts. You might even describe the French and Indian War in the mid-18th century as one of the world's first world wars. North America in 1700 gives you a very contemporary view of what North America was like, how it was controlled. You've got Nouvelle-France in modern-day Canada. You've got the various English colonies. You can see Nouvelle-Angleterre. Of course, this is a French map. You've got Virginia. You've got Florida, which is a large mass of the southeast. And Mexico, stretching right up into the American West. The northern coasts of the western coast, Pacific coast of North America, are still not very closely defined. See by the fact that they portray California as an island, which it isn't, but that's a not desperately accurate French map. I think the Spanish knew that California wasn't an island, but maybe they just haven't told the French. Let's talk a little bit about wars. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about wars today. The War of the League of Augsburg is the first war that England gets involved with against the French. It's known as King William's War in America. Usually these wars have constantly posh names in Europe, and their equivalent is a very simple King or Queen So-and-So's War in America. You might come across them referred to as either. The War of the League of Augsburg, anyway, is also known as King William's War. And it is the war that William of Orange took England into, or Britain into, immediately after becoming king. I mean, that was his main purpose of him becoming king of England, was to bring English might in with the Dutch and actually the Austrians, basically anyone who wanted to join in against Louis XIV. So, in America, you do get some conflict in New England and neighbouring Acadia. Acadia is a French territory. In modern-day Nova Scotia. The treaty ending the war in 1697, the Treaty of Ryswick, left North America pretty much as it was before, status quo. So although there was some raiding, some conflict, some casualties, it's not a serious war in North America. The War of Spanish Succession, which breaks out just a few years later in 1701, known in America as Queen Anne's War, is a more serious affair. This is the whole issue of whether the French, a French prince, can become king of Spain, whether Spain will become a Bourbon territory. Of course, hitherto it had been a Habsburg territory. And eventually Louis XIV thinks it would be a good idea to have one of his sons as King of Spain. And there's a whole war about that. There are conflicts that spill over into North America, in New England, but as far south as South Carolina. But as evidence of the lack of uniformity of purpose of the English colonies in North America, New York actually doesn't join in against the fight against the French. And that's partly because it feels itself quite vulnerable. French are just across the Great Lakes in Canada, and upstate New York, settlements in upstate New York, for example Albany, they feel themselves very vulnerable, so they decide to stay out of this conflict completely. They don't join in their compatriots in New England. There isn't a vast amount of fighting in North America. Again, there's some. Britain, though, this is the war that features the great campaigns of Blenheim, where the might of the French army is defeated for the first time, really, under Louis XIV. Eventually, the European war peters out and is sealed, and signed, sealed, and ended by the Treaty of Utrecht. And there are some permanent cessations and changes of territory. The War of Spanish Succession is the one where Britain takes Gibraltar, still a thorny issue for the Spanish government, but this is when Gibraltar becomes a British territory. But there's also some changes in America. For example, Newfoundland. Newfoundland had not, up until now, been officially a British colony, but the Treaty of Utrecht acknowledges that Newfoundland had been settled by British people, even if it wasn't a formal British colony, and it becomes, in a way, part of the British imperial system after 1713. Its population is not desperately big, only about 7,500 in 1750, so it's not even the size of Charleston in terms of its population. But the main import of Newfoundland is control of the Grand Banks, control of the fishing grounds. Those fishing grounds are a major source of wealth, and controlling Newfoundland controls those fishing grounds. They, of course, have now been so overfished that the Grand Banks closed to commercial fishing. Have been for a number of years. Whether they will ever reopen, who knows. And secondly, another permanent change in North America is Nova Scotia, a new colony, which involved the conquest of Acadia, the French colony of Acadia, which had actually predated the founding of Jamestown, first settled in 1605 by a man called Samuel Champlain. Lake Champlain in New York State is named after him, by the way. The British had always been quite concerned about Acadia. It had been a territory that they were worried about. It lay in between Newfoundland, which was seen as friendly territory, and New England, and it was right on the shipping route for British vessels going from New England back to England. And it was always feared that French vessels from Acadia could come out and attack those trading vessels, you know, very readily. In 1710, the British soldiers conquer Acadia, except for a small bit at the end of it, the western edge of it, no, eastern edge of it, called the Ile Royale, which is left in French hands. And this conquest is recognised formally by the Treaty of Utrecht. About 2,000 French settlers who live in Acadia are left behind by the French, and the British, partly because it doesn't have a ready-made population willing to move into Acadia to replace them, encourages them to stay to help populate the colony. They are allowed, for example, to retain key aspects of their individuality and their culture, their specifically French culture, in return for some loose kind of allegiance to the British crown. Stressing this early period, it is a very loose sort of nominal allegiance. They don't have to swear particularly blood oaths or anything. And this is partly because the Acadians, as a group, come from southwest France originally, and they were not an integral or well-integrated part of French society. And a lot of them think that, well, they've made their life in North America now. Why go back to France, to a marginalised society? This issue about allegiance is one that doesn't really go away, and it sort of bubbles under the surface for a number of years. And by the mid-18th century, the fact that the Acadians won't swear an oath of loyalty, an outright oath of loyalty like all British subjects have to do, to the king becomes a real thorny issue. And eventually, in the mid-1750s, the Acadians are expelled from Acadia. And it sends a very clear message that Nova Scotia is going to end up being a British colony. And by that time, there are quite a number of British people who have migrated into Acadia, making it much more British anyway. And these Acadians, they gradually migrate south through the British colonies, generally not receiving any kind of hospitable welcome. Usually they're shunned. They find food, shelter, etc., extremely hard to come by. They're outsiders. And they continue to migrate. They reach the Carolinas in 1756. And eventually, several years after originally being expelled, they make their way to Louisiana, which of course is a French territory. And it's there that they eventually settle in the bayous near New Orleans. And the name Acadian gradually over time becomes corrupted. And it's the source of our word Cajun. So when you think of Cajun food, Cajun cooking, Cajun culture, it's originally these French Acadians who migrated from Nova Scotia all the way out to Louisiana in the 18th century. The British found then a new capital of Nova Scotia, Halifax. Why they named Halifax is always a bit, presumably after Lord Halifax, not after the slightly drab town in West Yorkshire. Why from Leeds? I could say that about Halifax. And they have even more migration encouraged from North America. Sorry, from England, to make Nova Scotia, New Scotland, even more part of the empire. And these are these two new colonies, as in a contemporary map. And again, you can see here, look, the Grand Banks, these great fishing grounds. And this bit here, this is the Ile Royale, which is going to become a bit of a thorny issue. The third colony is Georgia. Georgia is a very interesting colony. It's originally founded as a buffer state. It's a state to protect South Carolina from the Spanish. It's there mainly to stop the Spanish making easy inroads into what is the most wealthy and profitable English colony, South Carolina. But it also has a charitable stroke humanitarian purpose. It's meant to be a place where poor Protestants can come and live. Poor Protestants, perhaps they're in financial trouble in England or even in Europe, and they can find their 50-acre plot. They can start afresh, be given land. In order for this to work, though, the Georgia trustees, the people who were responsible for settling Georgia, decide they're going to ban slavery. And they're going to ban slavery not because of any outright humanitarian concern about slavery, that it's morally wrong. Several of the people who found Georgia are also members of the Royal African Company, which governs the slave trade. But instead, they think that slavery has a bad effect on the morality of white people. Slavery encouraged white people to be idle. And that defeats the whole purpose of the Georgia Plan, which is to provide productive employment for white people. So slavery is prohibited in Georgia between 1735 and 1751. Though by the mid-1740s, it's fairly clear that quite a lot of people are circumventing this ban and introducing slaves and using them. There's a big debate in Georgia as to whether to allow slavery in the late 1730s. A lot of the colonists who actually live in Georgia say they can't possibly work in Georgia, it's far too hot. They have to get these Africans in because they're used to working in this kind of heat. And you only have to look across the river at South Carolina to see an example of a very successful society built on the back of slave labour. And of course, they look across the river jealously. Gradually, the Georgia plan sort of falls apart. The number of migrants to Georgia is pretty low. The economy doesn't go anywhere. In contrast to South Carolina, some of the people who originally behind these philanthropic motives either die or move on to other projects. And so eventually the trust sort of falls apart, gives control back to the king, and one of the reforms that is made is that slavery is permitted. And Georgia takes off pretty quickly after that. Slaves are brought in by planters from South Carolina by their thousand, and Georgia very quickly develops a plantation economy very similar to South Carolina, partly because it has exactly the same topography and therefore can grow the same crops, rice and indigo, that grow so well in South Carolina. And in the 25 years between 1750 and 1775, in that window, Georgia becomes part of the plantation South. Even if a very juvenile member, there are increasing demands on land, which mean that more land is taken from the Creek Indians, relatively voluntarily, because most of coastal Georgia is pretty thinly populated by Indians. And Georgia is territory under the control of the Georgia government, migrates down to what becomes the Florida border on the Samaras River, and up the Savannah River into the heartlands of the Creek country. And this tells you a little bit about how Georgia is seen as the buffer just out of the line between the Savannah River and initially and the Altamaha, and then in 1763 they add the bit between the Altamaha and the St. Mary's. This is the St. Mary's River here. And this area was really a no-man's land between South Carolina and Florida. Nobody really knew where Florida's northern border was. Even the Spanish didn't really know where it was. And they claimed up to as far as Charlestown, really. And this is a way of the English stating their claim by settling these places. And you've got to remember that by 1775, the population of Georgia has many times over exceeded that of Florida. And the one thing the British are always able to do with their new colonies fairly quickly is populate them. In the ways in which the Spanish just can't get Spanish people to live in Florida. This is before, of course, condos and everything like that in Florida. This is when it's pretty miserable living in Florida. It's hot, it's sticky, there are mosquitoes everywhere. Compared to living somewhere much more profitable, like Peru or Mexico or Cuba, living in Florida is definitely a second best. And this shows you, that map shows you what the secessions were, these great big swathes of land. This map actually shows you where white people actually were, which shows you they gradually crept down the coast and crept up the Savannah River. And this whole area here was just empty of white people, right up here until this is the border of Alabama. And in the time of the Revolution, this wasn't really sort of settlement. But white settlement is down the coast and up the Savannah River. And the Creeks really are only in that sort of northern part of Georgia. You can't really see this from this map, but sort of in the sort of big central bit here, at the top, that's where Atlanta is. So, Creek country was that sort of northern area of Georgia, spreading into northern South Carolina, parts of Alabama, Tennessee. This is what the landscape looks like in Georgia. It's very flat. It's very marshy, and where it's not marsh, it's pine forest. It's quite daunting to go and settle in Georgia because you would have had to clear all the pine forest, wade through all the swamps to try and get anything. But the swamps are, the soil is wonderfully fertile if you can control the flow of the water. It's great for rice production if you can do it. Swamps are also full of rattlesnakes, water moccasins, alligators. They're not particularly hospitable environments. This stuff here, sort of dangly stuff, Spanish moss, which used to be collected by slaves and used by, we talked about the informal economy in the seminars and how the slaves would earn money. Well, collecting moss, using it as mattress stuffing, furniture stuffing, they would use it as a way of method of earning money because shopkeepers would pay them to collect it. And again, it's just the complete featurelessness of massive landscape. To me, it's not that reminiscent, not that different from, say, the Fenland landscape in England, except it's a lot hotter. But also, all these creeks and stuff, they're full of oysters and shrimp and crabs. Great seafood diet if you like seafood. So, carrying on with our war theme, the War of Austrian Succession in Europe, in America as King George's War, stretching from the 1740s, in the mid-1740s. There is a major battle in Georgia, the Battle of Bloody Marsh, where the Spanish try to invade South Carolina but get defeated in Georgia, which again showed the whole purpose and point of Georgia and how effective it was because the Spanish lose that battle. But the other significant American event is the capture of the Fort of Louisbourg, a massive fort that was built on the Ile Royale, that bit of Acadia, a bit of Nova Scotia that they left in French control. But after they'd gone to all the effort of capturing the Ile Royale, the treaty that ends the War of Austrian Succession gives back the fort, Louisbourg Fort, to the French in return for Madras. And if anything was going to bring home to you just how globalised these conflicts were becoming, a city in India is exchanged for a fort in Canada. And that sort of horse trading goes on increasingly in the 18th century as they trade off one island for another city. I mean, the Dutch and the English have done it before. The Dutch sign away their rights to the island of Manhattan in return for English signing away their rights to a very small island in the middle of the Indonesian island chain, which is was the world's sole supply of nutmeg. And the Dutch clearly felt they had a better deal getting this small island which grew nutmeg than the English, who got this swampy lowland island called Manhattan. So in 1750, this is the situation in North America. You've still got a lot of Spanish territory. You've got a lot of nominally French territory. This map overplays very much the amount of territory controlled by the French. Basically, they had settlements in New Orleans, in Canada, and on the main river systems in between. But the idea that they controlled all of the Mississippi and Missouri river systems is, I think, slightly fanciful. Certainly the Sioux would have... Cheyenne and various other tribes would have sort of said, hang on a minute, we haven't seen a Frenchman here for 50 years. So it's very much a nominal control. And again, I blew this bit up with the last map to show you which bit is going to be the key bit. Because this map, this previous map, shows you the crucial issue here. The French are connecting north-south. Canada to Louisiana, through the Great Lakes and the Mississippi-Ohio river systems. The British want to push westwards from their coastal confines, and perhaps join up with Hudson's Bay, which is also a British company, and link their two areas of North America together. And exactly the same thing happens in the late 19th century in Africa, where the big question is going to be, are the French going to make it from West Africa, like Senegal, right the way through to Ethiopia? Or are the British going to link up from South Africa to Egypt? And they meet 1898 at Khartoum, and it's the British that win out, and the British control Sudan in the end. So the British link Africa north-south before the French complete their link east-west. So anyway, the Seven Years' War in Britain, in Europe, known in America as the French and Indian War, which, if you wanted a study of nomenclature, it tells you who the American colonists think who started this war, started by the French and the Indians. It's the first time of all the wars that I've just talked about, it's the first time you've got a war that starts in America and spills into Europe, rather than the other way around. This is a war that starts in the Ohio Valley, and it's the Ohio Valley that is the crucial area, because if the English can stop the French controlling the Ohio River, then they're really putting a big dent in the French imperial ambitions in North America. If the French can secure control of the Ohio River, they've got a solid connection between Louisiana and Canada, and they can fill up that central part of North America. So you get British regulars in America joining with colonial troops, colonial militias, to attack the French forts in the Ohio Valley. And a young George Washington is involved in this. Because, of course, they're attacking partly from sort of northern parts of Virginia, across the Appalachians into the Ohio Valley. The war goes pretty badly for the English for the first 2 years. They're defeated several times. The French just have better resources, better men, better commanders. The English commanders, including Washington, are a bit rubbish. And the Americans... the French are much better organised, and they defeat several military forces sent against them by the British. And it looks like the French are going to control the Ohio Valley. However, once war breaks out in Europe, France has got a big problem. Because all those wars we talked about from 1689 onwards are really about French territorial ambitions in Europe, about growing size and power of the French state in Europe. England does not have territorial ambitions in Europe. In fact, although England often fights in Europe, it fights often by proxy, as by its own troops. Sometimes it prefers to pay the Prussians to do their fighting for them. And so, once your war breaks out in Europe, the French have to commit a sizable proportion of their resources to their own state and to safeguarding their own frontiers, which the British don't have to do. The British can expend all their energy to America and to India. And one of the first things they manage to do is actually cut off the naval supplies to the French colonies, which is a major has a major impact on the course of the war in North America. If the French colonies can't be resupplied from France, then they've got a serious problem. During the French and Indian War, you get the Albany Congress, Albany of New York, of 1754, which has the first concrete plan of union. Some people describe the Albany Plan as being the chance to avoid the American Revolution. Setting up a united British North American government, an imperial government, which worked in conjunction with Britain, that would have avoided a lot of the issues that then came out after the end of the French and Indian War in 1763. And this is one of the pieces of propaganda encouraging that union, join or die.
Was Georgia not in that?
Well, Georgia's often excluded. Georgia barely makes it into the Continental Congress, doesn't attend the First Continental Congress in 1775. Nova Scotia's not there. In New England's just one colony. So they're looking at the important parts. In 1758-9, the British launched a major three-pronged attack into Canada. Firstly, across Niagara, Straits of Niagara, round through modern-day Toronto and up towards Montreal. Secondly, striking directly north via Lake Champlain to the heart of French Canada, Montreal, Quebec City. And thirdly, down St. Lawrence. So the coastal route which comes down St. Lawrence to Quebec City. The British recaptured Louisbourg. Remember they captured it 10 years previously and had to give it back. Well, we captured it again, but this time they destroyed it, which means that even if they had to give it back again, the French would have to rebuild it. So this time they actually destroyed Louisbourg. In 1759, the key battle, the Battle of the Plains of Abraham, where a British force led by General Wolfe outside Quebec City meets the Marquis de Montcalm, French commander, and slightly unusually, both commanders are killed in that battle. But the British win the battle, and they therefore take Quebec City, the capital of French Canada. A year later, General Amherst takes Montreal, and by capturing Quebec City and Montreal, effectively you've conquered French Canada. There's no resistance left. There are no French forces in the field anymore. They've either been captured or killed, or otherwise dispersed. So 1760 marks the end of French rule in Canada, effectively. And this is how the map showing you how the attacks work, the three-pronged attack. One going westwards, one going north, and the other coming in from the east. And how brilliantly effective it was. But you should always be remembered that crucial for this was the cut-off of French supplies from Europe. The fact that French ships couldn't win the blockade, they couldn't get their forces in Quebec or in Montreal resupplied. Absolutely crucial. And it seems surprising when you look at it like that, that it took nearly a year from the surrender of Quebec to the surrender of Montreal. But you've got to think, well, for 6 months, perhaps 5 months of the year in Canada, it's difficult to campaign. It's difficult to attack anywhere because you haven't got the supplies, the food, and the weather's just so cold. This is still a place you can go and visit. This house, of course, is a later construction, but you can see the outer walls and the huge, massive ramparts and ditches that would have been a lot bigger at the time. at Lewisburg. I've shown you that painting before, haven't I? Death of General Wolfe. Very dramatic moment in American history. So, somewhat bizarrely, but no doubt pressured by dynastic considerations, Spain enters the war on the French side after they've already lost Canada. Sort of comes in as a late entrant. The problem is that the Spanish are even less well equipped to fight a war in America than the French. And so what happens is that the English decide, well, if you want to play with the big boys, you know, you can take some of the punishment. And very quickly, the British take Havana in Cuba, and they take Manila in the Philippines, again showing you the global reach of British power. The war ends fairly soon after. The Treaty of Paris of 1763 confirms that the French finally accept the British are going to control Canada. They accept that they've lost in Canada. And the Spanish are given back their two cities, Havana and Manila, but only in return for Florida, which is the only reason the British had gone and taken Havana and Manila in the first place. It was easier to conquer Havana than it was to conquer Florida. So you take one thing and swap it for another. France also loses key Caribbean islands, St. Vincent, Grenada, Tobago, you know, all of which end up being British colonies, an important shortage of sugars, spices, and all things nices. And of course, the French Indian War, the Treaty of Paris, confirms British control of India. 1756 had been Clive of India's great victory over Plessy over the French. And again, this is why this war can really be characterised as the first global war, because you've got action in the Pacific, in the Indian Ocean, in Europe, and in the Americas and the Caribbean. So in half a dozen different theatres of warfare, England and France are competing, and France definitely comes off worst. French Louisiana is deemed too much of a threat to be left in French hands, and so the British insist that the French cede Louisiana to Spain. It's almost like compensation for the loss of Florida. And they don't mind Spain so much because Spain is seen to be so much less of a threat than the French. Spain's on its long decline, and they feel that the Spanish will not be have imperial designs on any British territory. Quite why the British don't push to have Louisiana themselves, I'm not entirely clear about, but it's possible they didn't want to overextend themselves. I think the territory they take off France in 1763, they already think is pretty major, and it's going to require a lot of administration. I like this engraving. France kneels before Britannia. It's the French emblem kneeling before Britannia, the single mistress, giving her the keys to Quebec City, French Canada. And there's Quebec City in the background on a nice summer's day. And those sorts of iconographies are widely available in print publications of the time. And the British are very cocksure after defeating France in 1763. And the map of America looks quite different in 1763. And I put the two together so that you can see how different they look. Instead of that massive French blob in the middle, that's disappeared completely and replaced partly by Spanish Louisiana, but mainly by British territories. And the bizarre thing is, after the American War of Independence, when Spain gets Florida returned to it, Florida actually comes out controlling the entire southern coast of North America. Florida, Texas, California, it's all Spanish territory, which almost by accident makes Spain a really successful imperial power, even though it's not a very powerful power. People keep on giving things back to Spain because they don't think it's a threat. You know, Spain loses its territory in the end, but for a period there, it's like almost by accident Spain's come out pretty good. But in 1763, you've got the British control of all of North America, east of the Mississippi, including Canada. Britain sets out now organising its new colonies. In It splits Florida into two, which it's done before, you know, North and South Carolina. For a while, there's the East and the West Jerseys. So it's not unprecedented for them to be Norths and Souths or Easts and Wests of something. East Florida is basically the peninsula, but its capital is going to be St. Augustine, the historic Spanish town founded in 1565. West Florida is the panhandle of Florida, stretching as far as Mobile in modern-day Alabama, and its capital is going to be Pensacola, which is the spring break destination of choice for those in America. The problem the British have in Florida is that they haven't got enough people, because unlike the Acadians who stayed in Nova Scotia, Floridians, Spanish-born Floridians, leave pretty quickly, and they mainly go to Cuba, which, remember, is only 90 miles away from southern Florida. So it's relatively easy for them to travel to Cuba. The French settlers in parts of West Florida often stay, but there aren't that many of them. And they are increasingly alienated by, for example, the establishment of Anglicanism. People who move into Florida often come from Georgia and South Carolina. Remember, Georgia had been settled by people from South Carolina. Well, so is Florida, in a way. And northern parts of Florida, which border Georgia, again, have potential as rice cultivating areas. And had the revolution not intervened, it's possible that Florida would have become much more part of the plantation agricultural experience. But they don't really have enough time. There's only just over a decade, most of which is in some kind of economic turmoil, to really establish any kind of plantation system in Florida. And so the advances that are made are pretty limited. Though that, I think, is the general direction that Florida was moving in. And as if to show you the differences between the two, you can see, you know, West Florida here is the peninsula, so East Florida. And of course, the vast majority of this is the Everglades. And it wasn't until the late 19th century that anyone even ventured into southern Florida as a real place that white people were going to settle. Miami was founded in the 1890s. And up until that time, most people thought the panhandle was just a complete waste of time because it's just unusable land. The peninsula, it's not viable. The profitable bit of Florida is seen to be West Florida. That's the bit that has dry land, has potential. So really the only bit that becomes, you know, anglicised is that bit, see where St. Augustine is, that bit between St. Augustine and the top, which is certainly a very small area. And this shows you the size of West Florida, which starts out being just this bit here, but then in 1767 they up it a bit, and shows you that already within 5 years of the end of the English War, the British have got designs about how they're going to, you know, grow these territories, and I'll talk about more about them in a minute. Of course, these areas are prime hurricane territory nowadays. Mobile has been hit by more hurricanes than it can probably remember. Quebec, French Canada, the most populous non-English part of North America, has a population of around 80,000. Of course, all French. Once the British Army conquers Canada, Quebec is put under military rule. It's going to be ruled by generals. It's not going to be ruled by a parliamentary system, by a government. And the generals, in order not to see a wholesale, you know, depopulation of their country, order that basically everything that's been happening carries on happening. So all French traditions, customs, lifestyles, etc., are all allowed to continue pretty much unmolested. They're even able to keep Catholicism. And the man who rules Quebec for this period is very sympathetic to the French concerns. And he's looking at the long-term viability of French Canada. And it's not until 1774 that a new act is passed, the Quebec Act, which reorganises the colony. It establishes a much, much larger boundary of Quebec than we modern day think of Quebec. Quebec's already a pretty big place, you know, if you go there. But the 1774 version of Quebec, I'll show you a map of it in a minute, includes Ontario, which is, you know, Toronto and that sort of area, but also goes and includes Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, so large swathes of the Great Lakes and the territory either side. Crucially, and this is really important, the Quebec Act does not allow for a popularly elected assembly. And that is mainly done to safeguard the Catholic majority, because the Catholic majority, because they're Catholic, wouldn't be able to vote. So the Protestant minority who could vote, new settlers from England or from New England or any other English colonies, could vote. They could vote in people sympathetic to them. They could control the government. They could oppress the Catholic majority. And people who draw up the Quebec Act see this as a bad thing, that the majority could be oppressed by a minority, and therefore they don't have an elected assembly. The problem is that the Quebec Act comes just at a real crisis point of imperial relations between the American colonies and Britain. It comes just after the Boston Tea Party, comes just after Britain have retaliated after the Boston Tea Party by closing the ports of Boston. And the Quebec Act is often seen by Americans as a blueprint for the future government of American colonies, even though it really isn't, and never was intended to be. But Americans by this time are scrutinising every single piece of legislation that comes from Britain for any kind of dodgy things that might be associated with America. And this is one thing they find that screams alarm bells. You know, here is an American colony that is going to be governed arbitrarily. So that shows you, you know, how big they thought Quebec was going to be, which is huge. I mean, it's likely it would have been divided up in the future had, you know, the British controlled it. But the modern day Quebec finishes around here. So all of this is, you know, well, this bit's part of the United States, but that bit's Ontario here. So, what we have between 1607 and 1774 are 18 colonies founded in British North America. One of the questions you might ask yourselves is, why do only 13 of them become part of the United States? What happened to the Floridas? Well, to Quebec. Why did Georgia become one of the 13 colonies, but not Newfoundland and Nova Scotia? After all, Georgia was founded after both of those colonies. They do spend quite a bit of time in the 1760s and early 1770s looking to develop the new colonial territory they've got. Because one thing they do fairly early on in 1763 is pass a proclamation line, a line saying that white settlement is not able to go beyond this line. And that's done mainly to keep white settlement in a fairly consolidated form. Because the fear is the more diffuse English settlement becomes, the easier it is for Indians and foreign powers, perhaps the Spanish, perhaps even the French, to come back and attack colonies. Remember, King Philip's War had taught white people one thing, is that the more spread out you are, the easier you are to pick off. And so the proclamation line is meant to say, this line and no further. They also explain the proclamation line by saying they're protecting the Indian tribes across the Appalachians. I'm not sure how much I believe that, but they do say that. But perhaps another more plausible reason is that the British government wants to organise those territories itself, and it wants to be able to exploit those territories in the way that it sees fit. Therefore, if there is land to be sold, it wants to be the one to be selling it. What it doesn't want is a free-for-all across the mountains. Which is sort of what happens anyway, but they try and keep the proclamation line as a limit. So, these new ideas for colonies are an extension of West Florida, northwards up the Mississippi River, towards modern-day Natchez, but also had two new colonies in Trans-Appalachia, which they called Vandalia and Transylvania. I think this is before Bram Stoker wrote his book, so they weren't quite, you know, so worried about associating the word Transylvania with somewhere to live. And these territories end up being created straight after the American Revolution. They become Tennessee and Kentucky. Not under these names, obviously. And as I said, they can't prevent people making these migrations across the mountains, but the numbers are very, very small. But white people are already, after 1763, making inroads into Indian territory in the Appalachians. And this is what America looks like, North America looks like, in 1762, after the end of the French Indian War, pretty much after the end of the French and Indian War. You can see Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, New England, New York and Pennsylvania. Again, a lot of these places, their western boundaries are very ill-defined. Virginia, which is stretching itself right across to the Mississippi River, as is Carolina, and then Georgia, Florida at the bottom. And they even go so far to claim half, I mean, the Spanish territory only includes the southern bank of the Mississippi River. The idea being that you could then use your claims of the Mississippi River to navigate, you know, the use for shipping, to ship goods up and down the Mississippi River, which is the main thoroughfare, I remember. So, in 1763, Britain is at the height of its power. It's one of the peaks of the British Empire, 1763. It has stuffed the French, kicked them out of North America, kicked them out of India. The colonies were working well together. They've worked well together against the French, for instance. They were united of purpose. Britain's navy ruled the seas. The French were humbled at home and abroad. Britain dominates the world in 1763, easily the preeminent world power. And the question you've got to ask yourself, and the one that we will now have to wait until the summer term to find out, is how come it all goes so wrong so quickly? Within 13 years, you have the Declaration of Independence. Why does Britain lose control of North America? Are the seeds of destruction already sown? I feel like we should do the theme tune of the Descenders there. And these things you've got to think about, and perhaps you want to read about over the vacation. So you'll come back fully cognizant of the course of the American Revolution, of which there have been countless books written. And you can begin to make a dent on those part of your summer reading.